This podcast is brought to you by Art Margins, the online journal of East and Central European contemporary art. Download more podcasts and read interviews, articles, and reviews at www.artmargins.com.
We're here at the Go East Festival, the 12th Go East Festival, where there's been a symposium on the studio of Len Film. Len Film, one of the most famous Russian studios, which began life, depending on how you want to count it, in 1934 or 1918 or 1912. It's been a real centre of Russian film production from the very beginning. Some of the most famous Russian and Soviet directors worked there, directors including Grigory Kozintsev and Leonid Traubberg, who formed the Factory of the Eccentric Actor, FEX, in the 20s, Sergei Yudkevich. Then on, people in the 1930s, like Friedrich Ermler, through wartime productions, and then into the 70s with directors like Averbach, and up to date with contemporary directors, some of the best-known Russian directors, including Sokurov and German. We're here to talk a little bit about this symposium, which looked at pretty much the whole history, I guess, of the studio, through from the popular films that it made, like adaptations of Sherlock Holmes, through to fairly avant-garde films, children's animations, a whole range of work, which in some ways is sometimes overlooked, I think, in the history of Len Film. It's seen as these moments of greatness, whereas in fact the story is far more continuous. We're going to be talking to Barbara Wurm and Olaf Müller, who programmed this symposium and a film season to accompany it. So I suppose the first question would be to could you maybe put Len Film in some kind of context of Russian and Soviet filmmaking?
Russian and Soviet filmmaking would, of course, be one of the contexts, but another context was maybe the one that we were thinking of first, namely a kind of a world cinema context or a context of film history. And we're both very much concerned with the development that film history or the writing of film history is taking. And we think that there are quite symptomatic passages going on. And focusing on Len Film meant for us also focusing on some kind of alternative or the possibility of the writing of an alternative film history, so to speak. So you wouldn't have the biggest studio of the country, but like only number two or the second one, where we think that the atmosphere, the way people would work together, also the way the names, big names, relate to the big narrative of Soviet film history, are always kind of second ranked. So where you can maybe take a closer look to the core of things, rather than just to the names and to labels that have been attached to these big names already. That was one thought. Do you want to add anything to that?
No.
So as Olaf really knows, like in the international film history, he would say that Len Film is, as this number two studio, is much more similar to, say, the number two studios of Japan or of other countries than maybe to some other studios in Soviet film production. So that would be one thing. Of course, you would always compare, and I think the symposium did compare Len Film always to Mosfilm, which is, I mean, natural, because there has been quite some socialist competition, as we've learned, going on between the studios. And one of the hits, Chelovek Amphibia, the Amphibian Man, in 61 also stood out as this kind of very short-term victory of Len Film over Mosfilm, and it's also again symptomatic that a genre film is actually is a film that Land Film was popular for at that time.
Actually, one of the things that is actually quite symptomatic is that in Russia, some of the genre directors are, for example, very well remembered. I mean, we were talking about Jan Fried, who may not have been a genius of filmmaking, but those films are quite beloved, and there are quite a lot of people in Russia who really remember his films. I mean, probably most people outside of Russia have never heard of Jan Fried, so...
Do you think that you mentioned the idea of it being the second studio to Moss film? Do you think that in some way that status of as being the second studio, do you think that gave it a freedom, or do you think that was a more of a restrictive factor?
Well, it was one of the things we were actually thinking about during. Well, while putting the symposium together, but also, of course, during the symposium, we had the impression that there was a tad more freedom. I mean, Moss Film was the behemoth, and Moss Film could do certain things that Land Film could only do so far, for a very simple reason that Land Film did not have as big a budget as Moss Film. It's probably quite significant also if you consider that it was commonly Moss Film, those films were sent to Cannes, and it was Land Film, those films were sent to Berlin. It's not a rule. There are exceptions on both sides, etc., but I was quite surprised how many Land Films were in Berlin. Of course, the Golden Bears never went to Land Film Productions. It's so. I mean, and Cannes is of course the big thing, and the Berlinale is the not so completely very much big thing, so to speak. But I have the impression that the films that they, for example, showed in Berlin were often much more daring than what they showed in Cannes. So it's in the end, I think that Land Film was really the studio that, in quite a lot of ways, could do some stuff that Moss Film might have bigger problems with. Moss Film might have had the better or the bigger protection, particularly in the 50s and early 60s with PDF. There isn't a character like that at the point in time with Land Film. So due to this protection, Moss Film could also get away with quite a lot of things due to that. Land Film could get away with a lot of things due to the fact that they were this second studio. And I think it's also quite significant that if you look at the way in the end during Perestroika, etc., things played out, who was actually at the forefront? It was essentially an all-out attack by Land Film. If you think about the main films of that era, it's Land Film, Land Film, Land Film. There are a lot of films from other studios, of course, but they are by now forgotten. What people associate with this era is all-out Land Film.
It's Kovalov. Mm-hmm. It's Pierzymski. It's Olympiev. It's Yufit, of course.
It's on the bigger level, so to speak. Actually, German and Sakura.
And before that, of course, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, if those were really like the beacons, Kanevsky.
Yeah.
So, and I mean, we would have trouble remembering some Moss Film productions or from some other studios of that era that still have a significance, or where those directors were, let's say, became somebody.
So was it easier for Land Film to react to the changing situation like in the late 80s?
I don't think it was easier, but I think it was a kind of a pool where people would turn to, even if they had studied in Moscow, even mm-hmm. if they had studied at the FGIK. It was really Land Film where these people turned to work. And I mean, you know, people, I mentioned Yevgeny Yufit, who was like this total enfant terrible, who would never fit any given studio structure. I mean, at that time, he was not just prepared, but he actually addressed Sokurov to be a kind of mentor, which is something, you know, I think hard to find in Moss Film.
Well, as far from for changes, I guess... I guess both studios, for example, with the Thor era, proved quite well equipped, so to speak, to deal with the changes mm-hmm. in their own ways. But let's say Lenfilm could articulate it at certain points in a slightly different way than Mosfilm did. So it's one thing I forgot to mention is that, on the other hand, as you were asking about this, whether Lenfilm, due to being the number two, was in a certain kind protected, when there were the big purges of films, let's call it like that, in the years 67 to 69, Lenfilm was far more ravaged, so to speak, than Mosfilm. I mean, of that moment, we remember mainly the Mosfilms that were basically shelved. But if we count, there was much more by Lenfilm that was shelved.
Just something on studio, a kind of studio studies, let's put it that way. There are all these studios from the republics, like Vufku or Azer Film or Belgos Kino. This is, of course, not a republican studio. But you call it the second studio in, like, Russia. Is that, like, would you then say it's, like, a Russian studio, but it's kind of, like, a second-rate studio? Or why did you choose the word second?
Well, as I said, Mosfilm is the big one. Mm-hmm. And then there was the one that was not as big, and that's why we say the number two.
Okay, so quantity.
Yes, well, budgets, yes. Okay. Production width. But on the other hand...
We might also say that Mosfilm was always a little bit more conservative, just a tiny little bit, than Lenfilm.
But maybe that's because... there is something to the question, because Lenfilm, on the other hand, had, I think, throughout the history, kept that kind of regional attachment to it, whereas Mosfilm was never really standing for Moscow as such, but it had a much larger representational function, I would say. So, yeah, there's something also about the city, I mean, that keeps coming back in all the films, and especially in the one that featured so well here, Pirezzo Domi Story by Friedrich Ehrle, where actually the changes in history are reflected by the changes from the looks at this city.
You just mentioned Ehrle, and I mentioned him in the intro. He seems to me to be kind of the kind of hidden hero of the symposium. We've seen several of his films, Fragment of Empire, which is an amazing kind of film, and this very Facing the Judgment of History, which is an extraordinary documentary where you're constantly wondering what Ehrle's attitude is, and there's almost a sense to me that he's desperately trying to persuade himself. This is an exercise in self-persuasion.
I think it's a documentary. A
history.
Well, exactly, yeah. And it's not a documentary because it's obviously there's so many elements of it are very carefully staged. To me, it was an extraordinary film. It was maybe the revelation of the season, I think.
Yeah,
it's very good. It's also very good that you say a hidden star, because we were, of course, trying hard to hide him. But actually, when we called our opening talk Lenfilm's typical genius, we were basically only thinking of Friedrich Ehrle.
Well, also Averbach. I think those are the two. If we are talking hidden heroes or hidden geniuses, it's them. Although, they are certainly not, again, film history here and there. They are certainly not hidden in Russia. I mean, Ehrle has a certain standing there, so is Averbach. I mean, a lot of Russian film scholars get starry-eyed if you just mention Averbach. And he never really, although his films were shown outside the Soviet Union, it never clicked. Why? Maybe because he is, in a strange way, too delicate and discreet an artist. And also being a realist, and here we come to this this thing of how do we actually deal with film history, how do we subdivide it, so to speak. I mean, if you look at it ideologically, realism is us. The others were suppressed, so there had to be allegory. So the thing that we most strongly remember about Soviet film history are actually films that seem to go far more for allegory and for excess, films that go in a much lower key, and films which are politically really loaded, like the works of Ermler, one of the most committed political filmmakers in the whole history of cinema. They freaked us out, and they still freak us out. I mean, we are in big time denial often about the political content of certain directors that are generally featured, and we are, on the other hand, trying to avoid dealing with a lot of directors because we talk about their political commitment, so to speak. I guess the one exception of the rule is Barnett, and I guess that Barnett is embraced so wholeheartedly by so many is that you can kind of reconfigure him as a kind of displaced American filmmaker. And but what's Auerbach? I mean, where do you put him? Auerbach is really as Leningrad as it gets, and he's as Soviet as it gets. But it's not what we, in our rather cliched universe, would consider the great Soviet filmmaker. But Auerbach was one of the great Soviet filmmakers.
I mean, he's tremendously understated. And the other thing is that, you know, I suppose sometimes in the West, Soviet filmmakers particularly either fall into the category of being firebrand revolutionaries or these dreamy philosophizers. And so you get it's either Eisenstein or Tarkovsky. And there's very little perceived overlap between the two categories, and there aren't any other categories. So people like Ermler, who to me actually is quite a complex, he certainly is politically committed, but his characterization is terribly complex and you know, in some ways quite undermining of the political message.
Well, it's actually, and I said it in one of the introductions, that's one of the really fascinating things about Ermler. He was really constantly fighting with himself to a certain degree. He was a true believer on the one hand, and he was always skeptical. I mean, I would never really doubt Ermler's commitment to the Soviet cause. But on the other hand, there was obviously something nagging at him. I think he was really ridden by self-doubts. In a lot of ways, definitely in his late period. Self-doubts about his own artistry, but also self-doubts about what he committed to. And he actually was often quite reflective about all of that by actively undermining, so to speak, his own films. I mean, a film like The Great Citizen is probably one of the biggest, the Chinese box of truth. One layer opens after the other. You've got a film, a clave about a political incident. It's obvious that it's about a film about Kirov in the second part. But who is going around for all of this? It's Maxim. Maxim, the great socialist hero created by Lenfilm. When they are starting to recite Dostoevsky, without ever stating it. So, I mean, there's a whole constant play about truth and fiction. I mean, you don't do that as a... I mean, Ermler might have been naive in a lot of ways, but as all great naive directors and artists, he was, in his own way, he was extremely reflective about what he was doing there. He was quite conscious what he was doing there.
And I also think that Ermler, as other figures, but Ermler especially, is interesting not just because of the way that we look at film history from our kind of Western point of view, but also from the inside Soviet film history. Because one of the first comments we got when we showed the film list to our colleagues, especially the ones representing Lenfilm, was, why the hell Friedrich Ermler? So, I mean, he is labeled so clearly with Veliki Grazhdanin, the Great Citizen, with maybe even, Veliki Perelom, so with everything that is not considered worth looking at for a second time. And so for us, that I think, I mean, he's really one of the most ambivalent and that's why intriguing figures. The same would, I think, hold true for Vengerov if looked at the Thaw period, who unfortunately is a little bit under-focused at the symposium, but I mean, you can't just feature everyone, that's for sure.
So why didn't they like Ermler? Is it because of his biographical background, or because the films have so many words and not a lot of action?
No, I think I think there would just be one thing more provocative than featuring Ermler, and that would have been Alexander Ivanov. If we would have gone back to Zvezdy, the Stars, or to Soldati, or to Piero Rossiani, then it would have been a clearly just ideological question. But with Ermler, it's also the ideology that is clearly so pro-Soviet that it's from this kind of not very open and truthful point of view, dissident kind of point of view, that is still the main, I think, the leading force in film history, at least in the writing of film history of Soviet films, then of course they're the least to deserve a kind of review, so to speak. Mm-hmm. But then, and that's why, for example, the 50s would be so important for us, and we're extremely happy to have Sergei Kapterev here for someone who not only knows like the 50s by heart, but who can also say these would be the specifics of land film production at that time. But the reception of Heifetz's film Большая семья, The Big Family, was of course again something that made us maybe not so happy, because there, obviously, what we wanted to, what we aimed for, that kind of review of or to really find the little differences, nuances that differ. I mean, it's clearly on the surface, it's clearly like, it looks like socialist realism, but if you look at it closer, it really differs so much from, on every level, especially the ending, the open ending, and Sergei pointed that out. So it's, I think we should actually work more in depth on, and then on a broader, like, do 50s only, for example, to get people understand, or to get them to develop a closer look at things, and not just say, well, this is, I mean, Stalin was maybe still alive, or was just dead, and people didn't dare do anything else, and so, yeah.
But I mean, it's this kind of really cliched look at film history that nobody would ever dare to do with Western film culture. Mm-hmm. Although you could, for example, make with French cinema very much an exercise about the unbelievable oppression in French film culture in the 50s and the influence of de Gaulle and censorship at that time. But nobody wants to talk about that. Mm. And I mean, French cinema in the 50s is really a politically unbelievably oppressed cinema. And
here we show Rapoport for the opening talk. We show Cheryomushki, the film about the utopian architectural new life. And one of the first comments we got from a good friend and colleague, from a German journalist, was, well, all I see is propaganda. You know, and that's the kind of reaction that needs to be fought.
Wasn't Ermler part of the Cheka? So, I mean, if we showed a film by a director who was a Gestapo person, we would have terrible problems, but we don't have these problems here, and you even didn't mention it. So, isn't that interesting? We talk about propaganda, ideology, and even, I don't know, something, the hidden hero. But, you know, he was a Chekist, so, you know, where do we go there? Isn't that a problem for us, kind of like ethically?
Not at all. I think not at all. I mean, if you, like, Bologna last year, if you look at the film mm-hmm. program they had, there was, like, films that were 100% by Nazi people who would be, like, Nazi as Nazi can be. Mm-hmm. And being
like Karl Ritter or Gustav Uschitzky. I mean, all-out Nazis.
And you can still look at these films from a very different angle. And also, I think, I mean, since everybody knew that Ermler was a Czechist and that he became it during the Civil War and it was like some weapon for him as a person, I think it, I don't know, I mean,
Erna also made very much a myth out of being a Czechist. I mean, there were always these rumors about him having been a really bad guy. It seems, I think, Petya actually studied his service records and he was, it seems, a pencil pusher.
Well, he was busy making films.
No.
That was before,
He was in the 1890, 1920, something.
Well,
like
things
that
are changing right now concerning Gestapo and Cheka and NKVD anyway. So, I think we are much more relaxed looking at these things. I wanted to ask both of you. Because probably you've seen dozens of films, even outside what we've seen, and beyond that. You called it, like, can you give me the title again in full? It's called, in English, of
real,
the symposium?
Real avant-garde, in one word.
Okay.
Real avant-garde with Lent film through the short 20th century.
Okay, great, thank you. So, do you think that actually... this second studio in the Soviet Union was able to create something like, let's not say a style, we know that this didn't happen, but was there like a studio aesthetics like we know it, you know, from other studios, which, and the studio aesthetics sometimes can be connected not so much to style, but something really connected to the institution. For example, also being, I don't know, in the north of Russia, not in the south, where traditionally filmmaking was rooted, and a lot of filmmakers went to the south after the revolution. I mean, why would you go north to make films when there's not a lot of light? And is that like something which would be really important for this kind of like studio aesthetics? Being really very, you know, what you said, you know, it's kind of like, it's all sets, it's kind of, the light is very specific, or I don't know, I don't know that much about Len film.
I wouldn't connect it so much to a style, for me, I would connect it a lot more to a kind of habitus, or a kind of...
An attitude,
a kind of possibilities and collective working. An atmosphere also. I mean, Svetlana Proskurina's talk, I think, made it very clear that it was so much about atmosphere. And also Olga Sherwood's already published text, it's all about the moral function of the studio. And that's why she's, I mean, basically crying when she talks about the current situation. Because she said there would be a chance to build this up, and it would be a place for people who are talented to come back. But if none of the professionals or the bureaucrats are taking an effort, then it won't happen, of course. So it's more it's something actually ethical,
okay.
in a way, more maybe. On this kind of humanist, even humanist level. And that's why Auerbach became so important. And I think the ending of Monologue is really such a nice and subtle way of introducing yourself. And you know you are restricted to your own borders and to the Cold War thing. But then this, you know, this scientist, I mean, you have worked so much on these biopics and also the scientists in these biopics. Like, I mean, how many steps is that away from the big Pavlov or whatever films? So this is the scientist who is good at what he does. He's kind of a Soviet representational scientist, but on the other hand, what matters to him is much more his family life and his own individual ethics also in representing this kind of Soviet society. And he really wants to open up. He's like stretching his hands to this other part of the world, and there's some... things about humanism or a new form of attempt to communicate that really like is really touching to me.
Yeah, I think it's difficult to see. You know, obviously, there's always this tension between the studio and the auteur, and I think it's very difficult to see Len film. You know, in Western terms, as a kind of an MGM or a Warner's, which had a studio style, like you say, I think, as you say, it's more of a an ethical approach.
Yeah, but also like what Peter Pagrov said at the discussion, I think that was something very important. He said that it was not just ethical, but also on a professional level. Not so much that somebody mm-hmm. told you that like our film should look like that, but there were editors, redaktorin, who really took care of the quality of the whole production process.
And yeah, the redaktor is more like a kind of a production manager.
Who like really takes the responsibility for what the whole thing turns out.
The Adolf Minkins of the world. No, but actually, Kaptjadev is actually in his book pointing towards a difference between, for example, Moss film and Lent film, when he points out that the general, let's say, emotional level in Lent film productions is decidedly different from that in Moss film productions. And that Lent film productions usually shy away from the, let's say, from the grander gestures. That Moss film is much more interested in the grand gestures, that Lent film is more interested in the quieter gestures, the smaller gestures, which probably makes them actually, and now we are coming back to our days, actually more modern to look at. I think that if, as we said in our introductory talk, this whole thing developed out of, let's say, out of an accident. Most things we were interested in the last few years with regards to Soviet cinema, we always ended up with Lent film. Whatever we looked at, whatever we started to study, Lent film. There are only one or two names I could give that I'm fascinated by, whether Moss film or any other studio. It's always Lent film. And so there is obviously something to that studio that at least draws us always back to it, and I guess this is really this very clear-cut, quiet, ethical precision.
Mm-hmm. I suppose, Barbara, you just mentioned a couple of minutes ago the Olga Sherwood and the final session, which I think in Soviet terminology would be described as a stormy debate. Which was a discussion about where Lent film is at the moment and where it may be in the future. And as we've hinted already, the future is far from clear. Could you give us some insights into, I mean, a kind of overview of the various views of what the possibilities are.
For me, it was actually looked at it from like 2 days distance. It's actually very depressing what happened because like the head of the studio kept saying that yeah, everything is fine and we're doing fine. At the same time, he told us that within the next 5 months, not only the physical units will be handed over to Gosfilmofond, but also the rights. So, I mean, Lent film, they're really the only chance that is now for Lent film to survive in a certain way is really as a production center. And, I mean, there is hope for that, of course. But I think maybe you'd actually need to embrace the big figures, like Sokurov again and maybe others.
Sorry, what did Shaidakov, that's his name, mean by physical units? Only the film prints, but going back to which year, or you don't know, or
basically all of them, yeah. because the archive. I mean, it's the situation mm-hmm. now is that Lent film is split up already in a studio and in an archive, yeah. mm-hmm. and the archive it's Georgi Moutkin who is like the person to address to if you're asking for rights, not even the director of the studio. And all his archive is moving to Gosfilmofond.
And when was that decided?
Decided only a few weeks ago.
Oh, okay. Yeah. But they mentioned something like that they gave the rights away in 2003?
I think they sold them to a television station.
Yeah, they sold them to NTV, I think.
Yeah. Yes. I think the right question is like really alert for the last 10 years now.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But, yeah, I mean the
one should say that if Putin wanted to do something for the studio, he would actually see to it that they actually get that the rights remain with them, because something we will learn from, or we learned from all major Hollywood studios, whatever kind of entity they are now, is that they very much live on their libraries.
Absolutely so, yeah.
No, but the really depressing thing for me was that today at breakfast, talking with Olga Sherwood again about it, was that she had the impression that really, I mean, they were doing their discussion, and nothing of whatever concerns them would ever transfer to us, because we don't get it. We don't have an idea, and you can always quarrel. Should you address Putin, or shouldn't you address Putin? Is it good that Putin gave Sukurov money? Is it good that Sukurov now doesn't want to talk to Putin, etc.? And she was actually addressed by a Russian who lives in Germany for 30 years now. She's also some kind of part of that cinema community. And that woman suggested her to get a good legal advisor. And I mean, Olga Sherwood nearly cracked up laughing, because I mean, a legal advisor in Russia, I mean, there is no understanding whatsoever of the chaotic situation, and it's like a complete rip-off that's happening for the last 20 years.
Yeah.
People just selling things that they don't own, that they were given, that they took for themselves. It's just a way of making money for like 80% of the people involved. And the rest is like the poor 20% that is...
We can be happy that, you know, it goes to Gosfilmer Fund and not to, I don't know.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Some oligarch.
Yeah, or no, some I don't know, even
absolutely.
A company abroad.
You can be happy, but on the other hand, I mean, Gosfilmer Fund is also, you know, I mean, it so much depends on the personal, and you wouldn't think of that. But
can you just say this about the letter, because you mentioned that, maybe just explain what it was about.
Oh, we're still. It was actually a suggestion by a Russian journalist that she found it so thrilling that we're doing this symposium, that so many people attend the sessions. It's such good reactions, and at the same time in St. Petersburg and Russia wide, definitely nobody gives a damn of what's happening. That she suggested we should just write an open letter, and the question is what is in the letter. The other question is who should we address it to. I mean, this is again the question, but it will be published in Novaya Gazeta and also in St. Petersburg, Nivedomosti, as I said, Vedomosti. Just as a basically symbolic signature and
symbolic
voice we could call it protest, but just a kind of
a show of concern.
Yeah.
Well, notification that this is being recognised abroad, that this isn't something that can just be kind of slipped under the carpet. Because nobody overseas cares or recognises the fact that Len Film does or doesn't exist.
I mean, that was actually also one of the things, now that you mention it, that quite a few people asked us when we were telling friends about it. Oh, do they still exist? And we said, yeah, they're even still producing. Oh.
In Russia, you mean?
No, here.
Okay. But was there like was there something in the letter which was like a suggestion, or was it just saying we are against demolishing the Len Film?
We still haven't written it.
Oh, okay.
It's really just the idea, there was nothing against anything and nothing also, but. Obviously, symbolically enough, I mean, it hasn't even been written, but there are already voices that hint on some certain formulation of the text. So it's, of course. What Shaidakov, the director of the studio, wants to avoid is the politicization of the situation, which is, on the one hand, understandable, but on the other, I mean...
Let me put it like this.
It's all about politics.
Yes, I mean, if you are talking about the whole time about business, this is politics as well.
Yes, of course.
So,
but also, I mean, during that discussion, the name that kept coming up was Putin's name.
Of course.
And Putin's involvement and simultaneous non-involvement in the fate of the studio.
It's just clear that, I mean, it's not our duty, and it's not we don't have the power to change anything, of course. But as for our Russian colleagues and for the maybe 20% that I was talking about, it's just very important to get a reaction. Same as it is very important also for the festival director Gabi Babic to hear that it made sense to do, you know, such a focus, even if it maybe at first glance looked a little bit, let's say, outdated in comparison to other symposium ideas that were much more like contemporary, interdisciplinary, whatever.
But you, when you chose a topic, you didn't know yet that there would be this problem with Lent film, right?
Well, basically we knew, situation was already quite clear. We never knew in which way it would develop, and I mean, we still don't, actually.
wasn't that kind of quite frightening to be embarking on this project and to be thinking, well, you know, in 9 months or a year's time when it comes to fruition, the organisation may not exist, and, you know, we may not be able to get prints, and, you know, we may not be able to get any support.
It was not frightening, but it was certainly deranging, and also not so easy to concerning the politics of who do you invite. You know, you don't know. I mean, you cannot invite the president when you're convinced that within 2 months he's not there anyway. Mm. And so as far as the representatives of Lent Film Studio are concerned, yes, we had a tough time strategic.
Well, one should say that it forced us to a certain degree to do a lot of things rather late, because we had to observe the situation. There was also, I mean, we got a lot of stuff from Gosfilmofond, and they had a major crisis because when the two major people, they were both ill. And
concerns the prints.
Yes, yes. And basically the whole structure ran to a standstill. And this was, for example, this was really something nobody could really really foresee, that this would happen. And I mean, we had before that we had a huge thaw program in Vienna, which really depended to really almost completely on Gosfilmofond, and compared to that, this was easy listening, because a lot of the prints did come from other sources. In Vienna, almost everything came from Gosfilmofond, and this was really on the razor's edge till the last moment.
But you see, I mean, the Vienna show, now Wiesbaden, and then before that, the Berlinale with the focus on Mishra Pom film. I mean, actually, the cultural ministry of Russia should by now understand that there is really a big interest in Soviet film history, and they just do not care about the situation at Gosfilmofond. I mean, these people, there's 3 or 4 people who have to... It's incredible. It's unimaginable. It's
paradoxical that this is, you know, it seems like the country is moving down this road where everything is seen only in terms of economic value, financial value. So it's paradoxical that there they have something which is obviously we regard it as being of huge cultural value, but simultaneously it is of huge financial and economic value.
But they are only dealing with it in a short-term way. I mean, you could, of course, develop something like Lent Film as a very long-term investment, so to speak, really through the library, etc. I mean, all of these are commodities. I mean, we are talking about, okay, it's. I mean, the nice thing about cinema is that it's still very much art and business at the same time. So they are really not developing what's really there to develop, also on a long-term basis. But they are only developing things on short-term basis.
Well, they're interested in other things, I think, when it comes to culture. It's much more connected to national identification, and this actually could be part of it, right? But somehow they don't see it as that. It's much more primitive. We talked about Michal Kopf and all that. I mean, he's getting all the money, and nothing goes to, you know.
Did we have to mention him?
But again, it's like all the rewriting of all the history books in school, you know, to say reinstate Stalin makes it sound like it's a kind of an anti-Stalinist whitewash, rather. But you know, the elevation of Stalin in the history books. And as you say, the fact that Mikhalkov can find money for basically whatever he wants to do, because he's presenting an acceptable national myth, whereas perhaps Len Film, historically, the national myth which Len Film is presenting is not acceptable anymore.
Yeah, but it's also really, it's again a question of short-term or long-term, because I think Mikhalkov is just a total phenomenon of today's way of dealing with things in Russia and here, that he's this little little figure that we can and agree on, what that the festival scenery can agree on. But I mean, he's ridiculing himself all the time, and he's just, I think for us, or at least for me, he's just going to be that little part, little ridiculous part who had big talent in the beginning and he just lost track. And
sorry, even in the beginning the talent was mediocre.
I know, we keep quarreling about that.
Yes. Historically speaking, I will be right.
No, but it's very important what you said about the national representation that is expected by Russian delegations, and that all the films produced, all of them, and Loznitsa's Shastimaya was just like the peak of that discussion, are looked at from an angle of, is he like putting dirt on our Saint
and
Russia?
Yes, he is. Definitely.
Yes, he is. And so that's one of the reasons why Ermla would basically, like, first glance also, it's just not en vogue.
Well, yeah, Soviet cinema would need a better PR, but, you know, that's like, you know, we're saying give them a better lobby and give them some PR. But actually, I think it's possible, but you have to kind of somehow give it the right twist. And Mikhalkov, actually, he tried to, he got a lot of money for his films, and it didn't help him at all, and they flopped. And now, I don't know what's happening now. I mean, I don't think they will give him that amount of money again. It's millions.
But I mean, still, it's the person who runs the Moscow Film Festival. It's the person who will appear in Venice or wherever every second or third year, because he's just this person we can agree on. And all the others, it still happens, and it happens for the last 20
years. Well, in the West, he's not so, they don't see him that critically, by the way. He got the Crystal Globe in Karlovy Vary 2 years ago.
People are blind. People are totally blind, and that's what I'm saying. It would make so much more sense for a Western kind of film culture, and of course there is no such thing. There are 20 or 30 different ones. It would make so much more sense to invite Yevgeny Margolit with his socialist avant-garde or avant-garde socialist program that really like twisted the view on Soviet film history for another time. He's not invited here. He can do his little niche program at the Moscow Film Festival, actually, run by Mikhalkov. So again, it's a question of politics, of invitation, representation.
But also again, strictly, really politically speaking, whom do you back? I mean, basically, Margolit is more or less like the kind of court jester at the court of Mikhalkov, who can do his strange little thing, but everybody expects the rest of the world to not really take it seriously. But hey, what happens if we do take the court jester seriously? And actually, if we do, what the hell will happen if we take the court jester more seriously than the court?
I haven't thought of him as the court jester of Mikhalkov. That's an interesting.
No, but I mean, inside the structure of a festival.
Yeah,
I mean, it's, you've got basically this grand reception stuff, and then over there there's Margolit.
Yeah, yeah.
And he's year in, year out, he's really rewriting history in grand letters and really twisting around everybody's perception of Soviet film history and really breaking new grounds. And yeah.
Okay.
But as this is also one of the things that we were concerned about, serious and intelligent work on film history by now is something like the job of court jesters and nerds. And maybe we also have to reconsider. Our attitudes to that as well. Maybe these aren't the court jesters and nerds, but the ones who might actually care more than most other people. Just an idea.
So that's like one of these last words. Okay, thank you, John Riley. John Riley is a music and film critic from London, and my name is Natasha Drobek. Thank you for listening.